The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. A review of biologicals is presented by Dr. Julie Sturbank.
So just to start out, I do want to say that I do not have any disclosures to make or any financial agreements that we need to talk about. So outside of my work at Natural Health, I lead a pretty boring life, so no fun financial disclosures. I did also want to acknowledge Dr. Hostoffer, Dr. Bob Hostoffer, who I think you probably don't see as often as perhaps maybe ACOP sees, but he is the Allergy Immunology Program Director for the fellowship where I graduated. He was supposed to be with us today and unfortunately had some family circumstances that kept him from being here. So he was kind enough to share his slides. So I certainly do owe some appreciation to him for his contributions to the slides and want to make sure that you know that. Couple things I just want to mention, because oftentimes if I say that I'm an assistant clinical professor at Case, people look at me and say, you mean in Cleveland? And I'm like, yeah, it's in Cleveland. But there are actually three affiliates to Case right now. So the Cleveland Clinic is one of them. Case Western Reserve's University Hospitals of Cleveland, formerly the University Hospitals of Cleveland, is also an affiliate. But we're kind of the third affiliate that sometimes people don't realize we're there. We're on the west side, the near west side of Cleveland, and we are the hospital safety net for that area. So we take all comers. We provide a lot of financial assistance to people, and we're fortunate because our facility is actually fairly well run and has not had the same kinds of issues that some of the county hospitals have had. And just to put in a plug for being open for opportunities, one of the biggest things that we've had recently happen is HealthSpan, which was part of the Mercy Health System, formerly part of the Kaiser System, actually went under about a year and a half ago. And we acquired a huge volume of patients that otherwise would not have providers. So I always tell my residents when I'm teaching them to make sure that you're open to the opportunities that present yourself, because I can tell you, never in a million years did I ever anticipate that that was going to be what was going to happen. So it was definitely an interesting problem to work through. Many of the providers and I were going out to four and five different sites to help cover during that time frame. So you never know what's going to happen. And then the next thing I just want to mention is my first experience with MetroHealth. Just so you know, if you're from the Cleveland area, there's an east side and a west side, and there's this thing called the river that runs through. And you don't always get people crossing the river to go to different sides of the city. So I was raised on the east side near the Cleveland Clinic and near University Hospitals of Cleveland. So when I decided to do my residency in internal medicine and pediatrics at Metro, my family was like, you're going to do what? And I just wanted to share with you my first experience, which many people's first experience with MetroHealth is our life flight. And you can see we have more than one, obviously, helicopter here. But kind of the neat thing was I at least knew about MetroHealth because John Pakella, who is in emergency medicine, he's a DO, he used to come to our medical school to lecture about emergency medicine. So that was my first interaction. And then tomorrow, when you hear J.D. Polk speak, who's the keynote speaker, I've heard him before. He also, once upon a time, and several years ago, he'll tell you, he actually managed Life Flight. So we've got some good DO roots going here. All right, so to keep going, we're going to go over the basics of skin immunology and the similarities and the differences between the innate and adaptive immune system. We're going to talk about the etiologies of allergic versus atopic skin disease and the inadequacies of current topical and immunosuppressive treatments. And we're going to talk about the biologicals that are now available for allergic and atopic skin disease. So this is just a schematic, but I think it's helpful to know that there are many, many different cells that exist in the skin that help function with the immune system. And I think one of the things that's kind of frustrating and kind of scary for lots of people, and why I spend a lot of time talking about rashes and dealing with rashes, is because people are not as familiar with that, I think, on the adult side. So I was trained in internal medicine and pediatrics, and I think in peds we see quite a bit in the skin and not quite as much in adults, or by then we kind of know what's going on if it started in childhood. So just be aware that there are a lot of different players in this process, and for your purposes, you probably really don't need to know what all of these cells do and what the different pathways are. You kind of just have to be familiar with the fact that there's a lot of things going on here and there are different parts of the immune system interacting. When we start talking about how to try to figure out what might be causing different things, it is helpful if you know what part of the immune system is functioning. But again, you can get really kind of overburdened with information about signals and receptors and all these fun, crazy things. And I promise you, I'm not going to make you know that. So you don't have to worry about that. So moving forward here. So the key things about the innate versus the adaptive immune system that I just want you to be aware of is the innate immune system is usually very nonspecific and fast acting. So that's kind of your first line of defense. And in Dr. Hostoffer's words, it's kind of like when you throw the hand grenade in. You're just going to blow up everything that's there. And yet, when you go on to the adaptive immune system, the response is usually more specific to the antigen, and it typically is a slow response. And for the initial exposure, repeated exposures usually respond more quickly. And in Dr. Hostoffer's words, it's more thought of like the smart bomb. Okay, so it's focused on a particular antigen. The one thing that I do caution people about saying to your patients is that there's kind of theoretically this idea that every time you are exposed to some type of allergen, that the response each time is going to be stronger and faster. We don't really have good studies, at least good clinical studies, that tell us that. So that's why I say it's more of a theoretical thing. So for example, when we see kids with seasonal allergies and it's early spring and they're responding to tree pollens, I've had people say to them, well, you know, you really have to make sure you get your child tested because in the future it may go further to anaphylaxis. And I think people are well-intended and they're trying to get their kids trying to encourage parents to get their kids tested, but we don't usually see seasonal allergies push over into anaphylaxis. So theoretically, we think that each time people's exposure to certain antigens can be stronger and faster and potentially deadly, but it doesn't seem to be that way in all allergens. So I always caution people as to what you say to your patients because it sets an expectation that they don't necessarily understand. And then they come to me and I'm trying to explain to them that no, your child doesn't need the now $600 EpiPen, which I'm sure you all have heard about in the news. So we'll just keep moving here. So this is also some words just to kind of give you some idea, a comparison for the innate versus adaptive immune systems. And it kind of just helps you kind of in words. And then for those of you, I've also learned too, whoops, I want to go forward, not back. So let's try this again. So for those of you who like more of the pictorial kind of thing, here you have the adaptive versus innate immune system, kind of more as the Venn diagram. And the nice thing about this is you'll notice that it does explain that there is some overlap. And again, this is oversimplified in terms of all the different pathways we know. We know that the immune system actually has a lot of repetition in it as well. Kind of, we think, as more of an ecologic kind of survival of the fittest kind of coming down the pike, so that if there are lapses or problems or holes in the immune system, there's a lot of repetition. Now, given that, I mean, that's a good thing for us as human beings. For us as clinicians, that makes it very difficult because then it's kind of hard to figure out what exactly is responsible for what if one area of the immune system is the area that's failing and yet there's another area that picks up for that. And so that can be very confusing in terms of trying to figure out what's going on. And just to go on over this a little bit further, so we have, this is just, again, another schematic and some lists of cells that you may see. And I'm not going to get into all of the functioning of the different cells, but just suffice to say, the mast cells in the skin are usually the ones that are considered to be the most significant in terms of response for the immune system. And they typically have, the schematic here kind of shows you, you see the Ys of the actual immunoglobulins and antibodies, and then you see cross-linking with an antigen. And once that cross-linking happens, that's where the cell degranulates, and all of those lovely mediators that are in the mast cell start flooding into the system. And that's where you tend to see things, problems with anaphylaxis, things like itching, swelling, hives, those kinds of fun things. And then in severe cases, there are enough mediators that if you have a systemic response that you obviously ultimately can lose blood pressure. And so I always like to include pictures about what this really looks like just to show you that there really are mast cells under the microscope, and they really do, all of those little black holes there that you see, those are all of those different little mediators are in those actual vacuoles there, and those really do degranulate and can cause quite a problem, especially if it's a systemic allergic reaction. And then as part of the adaptive immune system, so you have kind of more of the smart or the more of the educated system, and it's going to respond to something more specific. So it's actually going to look at things like, say, for example, if you have a viral infection or something like that, or if you see the flu or rhinovirus or things like that, it's not going to all respond all hands on deck right away. It's going to respond in a more unique fashion and a more specific fashion to try to take care of that specific virus or that specific problem. And then this is a schematic of an antigen and an antibody. And this is actually, so I did include pictures with this too, because, I mean, this is something that I think people see in textbooks all the time, but the reality is, if you look at these things, they really do exist. So I think it's just kind of fun to see under the microscope that these are real schematics of things that really do exist. And here's another one a little bit further back so you can see it on more cells. Okay. And then trying to make that bridge between the immune systems, the innate immune system versus the adaptive immune system. So there are a lot of different pathways, but the thing that I'd like you to take away is that there are protein receptors called toll receptors. They actually recognize the structure, and whenever your immune system is responding, I explain to patients that what it's doing is it's responding to a shape of a protein. So even smaller than a molecule, it's looking at shapes of proteins or even parts of those proteins. And so the toll receptors do recognize that, and they actually signal the response into the skin and into the mucosa when they are breached. So when that innate system is breached, that's when the adaptive immune system will kick in. And so this is kind of a schematic as well, and you'll see up on the surface, right under the title, the TLR4, that's a toll receptor. So you can see it goes and triggers a lot of different things, and even this diagram is relatively simplified, but it's just to give you an idea to understand that there are a lot of different pathways and a lot of things going on here. So in other words, there can be a lot of things that go wrong, and it's hard to figure out what part is the issue. So what I wanted to talk about is, so how does this relate to allergic skin disease? And in the next topic, I'm going to talk a little bit more about allergic dermatitis versus contact dermatitis, because those are different parts of the immune system functioning. And when I'm working with people, I try to explain to them that if you know parts of these different things, you can identify which section of the immune system you need to target. But the thing about atopic dermatitis, and I do want to say this very clearly, that yes, we do see it in children, but we see it in adults as well. And some of the worst cases of atopic dermatitis, both in children as well as adults, I have not found an allergic trigger for it. So I always say, let me repeat that again. We like to think that there's an allergic trigger and it's the allergy that's causing the problem with the atopic dermatitis, but the truth is, it is not always, seems not always to be allergy mediated, and oftentimes we don't find a specific trigger. Do we see it associated with allergic disease? Absolutely, but I also see it in people who don't have allergic disease. And so just keep that in mind. The way I explain atopic dermatitis to the patients or the families or both is I talk to them about the fact that we believe it's actually a defect in the protein structure of the skin. And so what happens is those people are it's much easier for them to lose moisture through their skin, and then it is much easier for antigens to get through into the inner barriers of the skin. So that's what tends to cause the problem. That being said, if there's something systemic going on with the patient, that also, anything that activates the immune system can make your atopic dermatitis worse. So for example, when you have somebody who has atopic dermatitis and they get a GI bug and they say, oh my gosh, I don't know what happened, but all of a sudden my skin is more itchy, it's red, it's flaky. That actually goes hand in hand with, as long as your immune system is activated, anything that activates the immune system oftentimes will make these responses in the skin more so. So just keep that in mind. And then just be aware that then once those antigens breach the initial part of the skin, they tend to then signal different pathways. And in atopic dermatitis, it's going to be interleukin-3 and interleukin-4 and IgE. So sometimes I'll even have patients who more of have an atopic flare and they may have a positive IgE. And I can sometimes tell you, it's not uncommon for me to see IgEs over 6,000. And as soon as people see IgE over 6,000, they want to say, okay, that's Jobe syndrome. And that's usually not the case. So just so you know, it's fairly normal for us to see IgE levels over 6,000 in highly atopic individuals. That does not mean that they have hyper-IgE syndrome or that they have Jobe syndrome. The other thing I would say is if you were going to go ahead and measure immunoglobulins, I always tell people, the clinicians that I work with, make sure that you order all of your immunoglobulins, so include A, E, G, and M. The G subclasses are not that important to us, unfortunately, because insurance companies, if we're going to do IgG replacement, they like the total number. They don't really care about the subclasses. So the subclasses tend to be more academic. But my point in saying go and order all the immunoglobulins if you're going to do that is because it's kind of like ordering a CBC without a diff. So if you send me an IgE that's over 6,000 and I have nothing else to compare it to, the first thing I'm going to do is going to be looking at the other immunoglobulins to try to see if it fits some kind of pattern. So the other thing that I also say is, and get to know your specialists in the area you work and the people that you refer to. And, you know, many of us, I think, just say, I don't know if I can speak for them, but I can say from our standpoint in our clinic, we usually say, if you're not comfortable or you're not familiar, please feel free just to send the patient to us. Don't feel like you have to do a workup before the patient comes. We will figure it out, and it's okay not to know what labs to draw ahead of time. So I don't get too hyped up about that. And then the other thing I want to mention about this slide is if there's a particular article that you're interested in looking at about atopic dermatitis, this actually is the one that's noted on the slide here, is probably a really good review for you to look at if you're interested in that. So this is a schematic because I also like to have schematics, like I said, words and pictures to back up what we're talking about. You can kind of see as we move from left to right, you'll notice that the acute phase, they include scratching. So that's one of the biggest problems that we deal with in atopic dermatitis, right? I mean, people itch, and itching is a horrible problem to control. I also have patients who get referred to me who have no rashes, no obvious atopic dermatitis, and they itch. And they want you to be able to tell them it's an allergy, and if they avoid whatever it is, that they're not going to itch. And let me just tell you, the best way I can describe it is I say to patients and to clinicians, it's a neuropathic pathway. So it's just like pain, unfortunately. And everybody has a different level of what sets them off and what sets them over kind of the edge. So in general, unfortunately, it tends to be a very difficult problem to control. And it usually involves us using fairly high doses of oral antihistamines to help control the itch. But the problem is, if you don't control the itch in people who have atopic dermatitis, they further breach that barrier, the top layer of the skin, and that just kind of perpetuates the problem, right? Because we all have skin flora on our skin, that also comes into play. So whenever you breach that barrier, you run the risk of all kinds of other problems, usually most often staph and strep, but you know, we see weird bugs all the time. So keep in mind it can be other things as well. All right, so what do we do with people who have atopic dermatitis? And so the interesting thing is, I would say that the vast majority of atopic dermatitis is controlled by just using basic kinds of treatments. And the most common things that we typically use are emollients. They have put some ceramides in the topical things that are out on the market. I have not really seen that really catch on very well, to be honest with you, mainly because they're expensive, and I don't see a lot of difference in those when I'm dealing with patients. What I find for patients is, I mean, it is a frustrating problem because people don't want to do the daily emollient therapy. I tell them at least twice a day. And I say at least, so you can do more than that. But a lot of times people don't even want to do that. And I can tell you, you know, horrendous stories about small children that come into our clinic and into our hospital where parents have been homeless and they have atrocious atopic dermatitis. And if the child gets admitted and the nurses are there doing the standard care of just using emollients twice a day, a lot of times, believe it or not, as terrible as that looks, it will improve and oftentimes even get near normal. So just to let you know, believe it or not, emollients do work in these situations if you can get the compliance. But the problem is, right, people don't want to do the compliance, unfortunately. I mean, and we're all human, so I do talk with my patients about, I get it, right? I mean, who wants to have to do this on a regular basis if they don't have to? The problem is you have to work with them to help them understand that they do have control over this and this will help them, but they do need to do it consistently. And that's very difficult, as we all know, in chronic disease. And then we also try to decrease the inflammatory process if they're still inflamed. So we use topical steroids and then sometimes topical anti-inflammatories, so like the calcineurin inhibitors, so your tacrolimus, your pacrolimus, those kinds of things. Again, those tend to be expensive, and unfortunately they also carry a black box warning on them because of their association with the oral medication causing cancer. So we have not really seen that in the topicals, but it still carries that warning. So we tend, again, not to use them first line, mainly because of that, but also because they tend to also be very expensive. So unfortunately, topical preparations tend to be pretty expensive, and so a lot of times we have to work through prior authorizations, and sometimes, or I shouldn't say sometimes, I would say it's fairly often that I'm trying to talk to somebody peer-to-peer on the phone who doesn't even understand that there are different classes of medications, and I would imagine those of you who also work in other and manage other chronic diseases probably experience that as well. So I'm there with you in the trenches with that frustration. Okay. And then I just mentioned a few things that we've been using in the past for the initial systemic treatments for atopic derm. And I start off the oral steroids here because I don't want to offend any dermatologists in the audience. I think I see dermatologists use oral steroids in atopic derm more than I do. I don't use it on a regular basis. And the reason why I don't is because these patients, and it's just such a frustrating problem, they flare like crazy when you try to get them off the oral steroids. So the problem is then you get kind of stuck in this perpetual cycle where you're trying to do a taper and then they flare again, and what happens? You have to give them higher dosages again and try to slow the taper again. And it is a very difficult problem. So I actually try not to use that. My derm colleagues probably use it more than I do. Oral antibiotics are often sometimes used if you have superinfection or people who have, gotten a staph or strep infection. And I don't want to negate that. We obviously have to be on board with that because they can get very sick with that. And then for people who fail those kinds of things and have failed the topical medications that I was talking about, we have been using for several years in an off-label fashion methotrexate and cyclosporin. Now, I was not trained to use methotrexate for these patients. I do have several derm colleagues that do, and I do refer to them when patients are not able to take cyclosporin. I can tell you, being the county safety net hospital, we have a lot of people who have uncontrolled blood pressure and uncontrolled diabetes. So I think when I first came back to Metro after I did my internal medicine pediatrics residency, and after I did allergy fellowship and I came back, I think most of my colleagues just about die every time I bring up cyclosporin because they're thinking about the fact that there's the renal implications with it and the side effects. The thing about it is when I'm talking about using that, I'm talking about using probably about a 15th of a dose of what you would use for somebody who had some type of organ transplant. So we're talking about a tiny little whiff just to kind of take off that overactivity of the immune system to try to get things to calm down, at least temporarily. And as we all know, methotrexate is not a benign drug either, which is part of the reason why could I treat those patients? I probably could, but I wasn't trained specifically to use methotrexate, so I tend to stick with things that I'm trained and familiar with when I use that, and I don't have any problem referring out to my colleagues in dermatology to help me out if I need them. So we also use other things. I don't want to say we don't use other things, but we do use other things. But these are probably the two that you'll probably see implicated most in the literature. Okay, halftime. Does anybody have any questions so far? I've blown you all away. Oh, there's a question in the back. I can repeat it if you, or the microphone's here. That's okay. Take your time. You're cool. Tell my family I put Script Ohio up. My sister went to Notre Dame. Are there any Domers here? I'm not supposed to do that. Just, I probably should have put the ND, sorry. Yes.
Do you have any experience in your clinic using Xolair for people who have atopic dermatitis?
Absolutely, and we're getting to that. You just jumped ahead of my talk. Okay. That's okay, we're gonna talk about, it's a biologic, so we absolutely are gonna talk about that. Anybody else? Okay, we'll keep moving. Okay, so where we use Xolair more than atopic dermatitis is gonna be in chronic urticaria. And so I do wanna mention, I see a ton of chronic urticaria. And when I say a ton, I know that's not a very scientific way to describe it, but I would say at least in a half clinic session, so if you're talking about, say, Monday morning in my clinic, I see at least 2 to 3 people that get referred to me for chronic urticaria. And the thing about these patients is they will have most likely, most of the times, driven themselves absolutely crazy because they are trying to figure out what they might be reacting to. And so what I always tend to have to explain to them is this is not an allergic phenomenon. Everybody sees hives and they always think, oh my gosh, this is allergy. Let me tell you, that's not the way I look at it because I see this, right? So I have a different frame of reference. But what I would tell you is I spend a lot of time talking to them about this is not something you're doing. This is something your system is doing. Your immune system is overactivated for some reason. We most often do not find out why. They hate that, right? Because we're all human and we want to know why. Because if we know why, then we can stop it. And they'll stop having flares like this. So just to give you some idea, it's an estimated 1.5 million people in the U.S. are affected by chronic urticaria. So when we say chronic urticaria, it lasts greater than 6 weeks of duration. They're having symptoms of hives, itching, and or angioedema several times in the week. Most days is what they say, most days of the week. I do have people that have episodes multiple times a day. I have people who I've seen it in young as 18 months, and I've seen it in people well over their 90s. And it's just amazing how a lot of times they will have somehow worked out in their mind what's causing this problem, and they'll think they're allergic to something, and then we allergy test them and they're not. And the problem with this disorder is it's a diagnosis of exclusion. Okay, so we rule out everything else, and then we're stuck with this disorder. And so again, people don't like to hear that, right? Because they want a reason for why their body's doing what they're doing. It's typically benign, as I mentioned here, but it can be the underlying, there can be an underlying condition. So we always check renal function, we always check liver function, I check thyroid when I see people with this. And usually, most often, it's seen between the ages, initial onset between the ages of 20 to 40 years. But as I told you, I've seen it in very, very young children, and I've seen it in elderly people. So I do see it pretty consistently. So we don't know exactly what causes it, and that's what I was just trying to explain. So we know that it doesn't appear to be an allergic disorder. What we think is most often cases are an autoimmune response to an actual IgE receptor on the basophils in mast cells. Sometimes it's actually the actual IgE molecule, but usually it's the receptor. And so it's the same process when you see somebody who has both angioedema and also have urticaria, it's the same process, okay? So if it's closer to the surface, you're gonna see the itching redness and less of the swelling. If you see it deeper in the tissues, you're gonna get swelling. The kind of caveat to that is if you're in an area of the body where there isn't a lot of connective tissue, so for example, the lips or the eyelids, those tend to swell. You tend not to see actual hives in those areas. But I do have people that their feet swell and they can't put shoes on, their hands swell, they can't grip things, but it's usually a generalized swelling. So not where you would think of, like, for example, rheumatoid arthritis where there'd be actual joint swelling. It's usually just generalized swelling. And again, so if it's deeper in the tissue, it's going to be angioedema. What do we do? So in these situations, I usually have to hit people pretty hard with both the H1 and H2 blockade. So the literature suggests you can start out with an H1 blockade. My experience is usually by the time people are coming to see me, they've tried that. So they'll use things like cetirizine, which is Xolair. I know I'm not supposed to say that, Xolair. Or I'm sorry, Zyrtec. They'll use things like fexofenadine, which is Allegra. Not supposed to say that brand name either. And then loratadine, which is your Claritin. Now, people sometimes will ask me what my experience is with Zizol. I haven't found that Zizol's any really different. The reason why people liked it before was it was still available only by prescription, right? So it just went to the market in the last, probably about last year, where people can get it over the counter. And I haven't really seen a whole lot of difference with that. So usually when people are coming to see me, I'm usually hitting them pretty hard with antihistamines. So I use H1, which is the things that I just mentioned that you're commonly familiar with for allergic disease, and then I oftentimes will add on either ranitidine or famotidine. So Ranitidine is going to be your Zantac, Famotidine is going to be your Pepcid. And the reason for that, and I have to explain this multiple times because patients forget this, and then they go to the pharmacy and they get this filled, and then they get the patient information flyer that says that I've given them Ranitidine because it's used for reflux. And they'll call my office and they'll say, but I don't have reflux. Did the doctor really mean to give this to me? And my nurses are very familiar with that question. So I usually don't get asked that question. It's usually my nurses who are responding and saying, yes, there's a reason for that. There are histamine receptors on the stomach. And that is why we're trying to block as many histamine receptors as possible with these patients to try to see if we can at least get them some relief. Because these are people who come in, and I kid you not, they cannot concentrate, they cannot sleep, they cannot work. I mean, it's really a bad problem to have. We oftentimes end up having to add on leukotriene inhibitors, so things like montelukast, which is your Singulair. My experience with that is I tend to find that it's more helpful in children than it has been in adults. Just, and again, that's anecdotal from me. I do once in a while find an adult patient where it works. And heck, if giving them Singulair once a day works, then we're good. We're going to do that. And then if they typically in the past, if they failed these kinds of things, then we were stuck again with using things like methotrexate and cyclosporin. So actually cyclosporin we were using up until, I'm trying to think, probably halfway through my fellowship, which was back in, let's see, 2012-ish, and then that was when we went further, and that was when omaluzumab, which is Xolair, which the woman asked about, that actually got a first-line indication for chronic urticaria, so we're going to talk about that. All right, so this is just a schematic of treating the chronic urticaria stepwise, and they start to talk out by using H1 or H1 antagonists first, blockers, and then moving up the ladder here. You'll notice in the end we'll talk about what to do when people fail the biologics, because now we're starting to see people who fail biologics. Okay, so just to recap, as we were talking before, so I talked about atopic dermatitis, and I talked about what we typically would use would be emollients, the oral antihistamines for itching, the topical steroids, and the immunosuppressants. And then we were talking about chronic urticaria, the oral antihistamines, and the oral immunosuppressants if people fail the oral antihistamines. So what about treatment failure? And so this is kind of the crux of what we were trying to talk about today, even though there's not a lot out there in terms of biologics to use. But the point is, unfortunately, there is no standard classification for either one of these skin diseases. So there's an excellent review on the FDA.gov where there was testimony about why we need to try to pilot more of these drugs and more biologicals in children because of treatment failure related to atopic derm. But I can tell you, in adults, some of these really severe cases of atopic dermatitis, they need things too. They need to be able to have some type of treatment that's available to them, because these people, they're red, they hurt, their skin cracks, it's very painful, it's burning, and some people really do have it widespread. So it's really kind of sad when you see people like that, because you really don't have a lot to offer them if they're not willing to do the immunosuppressants. And like I said, methotrexate and cyclosporin, they're not without side effects and they're not without risks, and not that we can't use them, but you do have to monitor those patients very carefully, because you don't, you know, want to miss something that you've then given them some other major problem, you know, related to their lungs or related to their liver or their renal function if they didn't have that to begin with. Now, that being said, I also get people who don't want to give oral medications like that because they think it's just a skin disease. And the problem with that is, like I said, until you see these folks and see how miserable these folks really are and see how much this impedes their life, that's where you start to realize it would be helpful if we had other things available to these patients. And so, as I mentioned there, I talk about patients that have chronic itching. They have decreased quality of life, and some of the articles even suggest it's so severe as people that have diabetes and heart failure, to give you some idea. So this is just a complicated tiny chart. I don't expect you to read it, but it's in the slides, and we'll make sure that you get updated slides so you can look at the different targets. This also talks about psoriasis. You've seen a lot of, I'm sure, a lot of direct marketing for psoriasis and the biologics because they've been doing a ton of that on the TV and things like that. So while we do have patients who come into us and ask about those therapies, again, because of the clientele that I deal with who are typically either uninsured or have Medicare, Medicaid only, I'm usually not able to get many of these things first line. So I'm usually trying to work through what we can do at least initially to get them some relief. Okay, so dupilumab. So this is actually available. It just got approved in February of 2017. So this is actually a monoclonal antibody that we use for atopic dermatitis. Actually, in my facility of Metro, dermatology has been using this a little bit more frequently than what I've been doing. It actually binds to one of the receptor subunits, so it interferes with the interleukin-4 and the interleukin-13 pathway. And again, you don't have to necessarily remember that, but just know that it blocks a receptor and it tends to decrease the side effects of the inflammation. So in patients like this, I always tell them this is not a cure. This is to also basically work in conjunction with emollient therapy. So I always tell people, you really cannot go wrong by doing emollient therapy unless somehow you find somebody, and there are people out there that have contact reactions to things like the petroleum, so in your Aquaphors or your Vaselines or things like that. But at any rate, that's not a real common occurrence. And then side effects also include, as always, with all of the monoclonals, allergic reactions. That's always the biggest thing you usually worry about. And for this particular one, it's also implicated with cold sores and some inflammation of the cornea. But in clinical trials in SOLO 1 and SOLO 2, which are the two big clinical trials that they used, people were reporting 75% of improvement or greater within 12 weeks of initiating therapy. So that is something to be said, if, like I said, if you have these people that are so severely impacted by it. And then you had the question about Xolair. So that's actually the one that I'm actually most familiar with just because we've had it around the longest. And as I said, it was approved for a first-line indication for chronic urticaria during my fellowship. And it's actually originally was used for the treatment of IgE-mediated asthma. And unfortunately, the question you were asking about was whether or not it's been shown to help in people who have atopic dermatitis. And my experience with that has been very spotty, which is what the literature also suggests, is for some people it seems to and other people it doesn't. And unfortunately, the only real way you know that is usually by trying it. You can pull an IgE level first to kind of see at least if you've got somebody with high IgE. And then those, I mean, I can honestly say those aren't always even the people that respond. So there are a lot of things going on with these things that we don't know, but I have tried it in people before dupilumab was approved because we didn't really have anything else to offer them. And if they had contraindications to doing the immunosuppressives, then we would try it at least and see. And I don't think I have anybody currently who's using it for atopic derm because it just, in my patients, it really didn't help. And so these medications are obviously very expensive because they're monoclonal antibodies. They require patients to come into the office to get the injections. If they're small children, of course, they a lot of times, unless you can find the kids that have the maturity level, and we do have some of them in the clinic, they don't understand why you're giving them a shot, so it can be very traumatic. So a lot of parents won't want to do that either. And then there are some adults who just have an aversion to getting shots. So if they haven't come to that conclusion where they need something like that, you're kind of stuck, right? Because you're not going to drag them into clinic, hold them down, and give them a shot. Or at least that's what we tell them we're not going to do, and I haven't done that yet. And then this particular monoclonal has a black box warning for late anaphylaxis. So they have seen late anaphylaxis in this particular medication. occurring 4 to 6 hours after the administration of the shot. So that we make sure that people have EpiPens, they know how to use them, and they have to bring them with them when they get a shot, and they need to have those available to them and be aware. So that's all part of the consent process that we go through when we start somebody on Xolair. So just to be aware again, this one we haven't seen a lot of other side effects with. I've had one patient who, and it's always hard to tell too, because if you don't have an objective marker, how much of it is subjective. I did have one patient who was complaining that she had muscle aches and felt nauseous right after the injection, and we didn't continue with her. Okay, let's keep going here. So the big drawbacks to those two biologics, and like I said, at least there's something there, is that these drugs literally cost thousands of dollars per injection. So some of the estimates are in the neighborhoods of somewhere between $40,000 to $75,000 for the medication alone per year. And then think about the fact that you have to administer them in an office, and for omalizumab, which is the Xolair, we have to actually monitor people for the first 3 injections for 2 hours, so there's also that cost associated with it. So, and again, there is a question about long-term risk related to cancer in these patients who are using Xolair. But the problem is we know that people who have an overactive immune system anyway tend to have an increased risk of cancer as well, so your lymphomas and things like that. So it's kind of hard to tell. What I tell patients is that there isn't a clear indication that there's an association, because if there were, we would pretty much know that. We use it enough now, and we've used it long enough in patients who have uncontrolled asthma. So what do we do when the biologics fail? Well, unfortunately, I'm starting to see people who have chronic urticaria that no matter what I throw at them, they're still having episodes, and they're still having very disruptive episodes in their lives. And then I'm kind of stuck because I don't have any other options. So that's where, and that stepwise ladder that was on the atopic, or I'm sorry, was on the chronic urticaria, whoops, goes back to, they actually go back to using, we have to use the immunosuppressives. So sometimes you're still stuck with immunosuppressives. All right, so I'm just going to run through a couple questions here, and then we'll take just general questions if people have them. So just keep in mind that, you know, typical treatment for these disorders, you are probably going to use topicals in atopic dermatitis. You're probably going to use oral antihistamines, both in atopic dermatitis and chronic urticaria. But know that there are a couple of options out there now, and there are going to be more to come with biologic therapies. And some people really need that to be able to function and be able to get their disease under control. So question one was, atopic dermatitis is a disease that, and it's A, either directly caused by allergic disease, always requires, B, is always requires a referral to an allergist, C, first-line therapy involves restoring the skin barrier, or D, requires aggressive symptom control, and then E is both C and D. So any takers for A? Any takers for B? Anybody for C? Okay, so C is right, first-line therapy is restoring the barrier, but D, you want also aggressive symptom control because you don't want those folks to scratch and make it worse. So let's see if I got that on there. Whoops, it's in there twice? It's on there twice. Okay, so I can tell you the answer is E. So question number two, I think we lost my formatting when we converted, but that's okay. Omalizumab, or Xolair, as I was talking about, is a humanized monoclonal antibody that was previously allowed to be self-administered. Kid you not, it was allowed to be self-administered. Currently, the FDA requires that patients receiving the drug to have a current epinephrine auto-injector and be familiar with its use, be observed in the office for a 2-hour wait period for the first 3 injections, be observed in the office for every injection from 4 to 6 hours. D, we gave you a couple of options of A and B, and E was A and C. So any takers for A? No? Any takers for B? Any takers for C? Anybody for A and B? Okay. Good. And E, we had A and C. So you're absolutely correct. The two correct statements are here that you, the patients have to have a current epinephrine auto-injector and be familiar with its use. And they also need to be observed in the office for a two-hour wait period for the first three injections. After that, we're able to move them down to 30 minutes after their injection, but they still have to have the epinephrine EpiPen and know how to use it, or an AviQ. And we do follow them pretty closely to make sure that they're not having problems afterwards. All right, question three. So the reason why we're talking about atopic dermatitis and chronic urticaria today is treatment failures can be easily managed with biologic therapies. Most providers are comfortable with using systemic therapies involving biologics and immunosuppressants for refractory cases of both of the conditions. C, there are typically effective treatments for both conditions the primary care physician should be familiar with. And then we have D, which is an option of A and C, or E, which is an option of B and C. So starting with A, anybody going for A? No? Okay. Anybody going for B? Anybody going for C? Good. And then A and C, anybody for D? Okay. And B and C for E? So what I would say is I honestly don't necessarily think that treatment failures are easily managed with biologic therapies, only because now, like I said, I'm seeing more refractory cases. And then the second reason is, I mean, it's a royal pain to get these things approved. But again, when you have somebody who really needs something, that's where, fortunately, I have staff that can help me get that across. But I, like I said, I'm still there with you in the trenches, and I'm still talking to the insurance companies. And, you know, it's just really hard, as you know, to be talking peer-to-peer to somebody who at least, you know, is a clinician, but a lot of times they're not familiar with even the disorders that you're talking about. So that's where I get pretty frustrated. I don't know about you guys. All right. So we'll go through there. Anybody with any specific questions about this one? Okay, again, I must have blown you all away because nobody's asking any questions. If you have questions, please don't ever, I honestly have no problem with people stopping me, asking me, emailing me at any time. I always say, why reinvent the wheel, right? So if somebody's done it before, if you have a question, please don't hesitate to ask. I love to teach, and I'm happy to share my experience, so I have no problems with that. And if I don't know the answer, I was fortunate. I trained with two great immunologists as well in the Cleveland area, and I still stay in contact with them all the time. So, you know, I always say I can at least phone a friend if I need to.